The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right. Well, welcome to a Friday. The good news is the world's still here. We're still standing in one sense or another. It's the or other that we need to worry about, I think. I am Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com here at 3 o'clock Eastern. Through the power of digital audio. We repeat weeknights at 6 Eastern on the Progressive Voices Network, however you listen. And of course, the magic of podcasting. We're available anytime you want us, as it should be, through the podcast, through iTunes or Stitcher or however you get your podcast. And welcome aboard. As you know, this show is always free because there are so many people who, even though we're told it's such a great economy, are still struggling. And I don't want to, keep anyone out. So we use the public radio model of volunteer, contributions, but they are your contributions that keep me going here. So, NicoleSandler.com/donate is where you can get all the details on the various ways to support the program. However you do, I thank you. And for those of you who have been supporting this program all along, I can't thank you enough. You're the only reason I'm able to keep doing it. So there's a lot going on today. There's no possible way I could cover it all. The latest news, if I had the breaking news chyron, it would be, it's back on again. Yes, just a week and a day after Dump sent a letter to Kim Jong-un saying, you know, the summit is off because you've been so rude to us. The summit's back on June 12th in Singapore. He didn't want all those coins to go to waste. So if you bought some, on sale, by the way, thinking that they'd be collector's items. Now they're just going to be, commemorative coins of what could turn out to be just a photo op, very much favoring Kim Jong-un because it gives him the legitimacy he's been craving. Jim Sciutto of CNN, after the meeting broke up at the White House between Kim's, I guess, second in command, and Donald Trump in the Oval Office. There was a lot of back and forth. I was in here in my studio prepping for the show, so I didn't see the shenanigans on TV, yet I was following it on Twitter. Jim Sciutto of CNN tweeted out, bottom line, North Korea committed to nothing and promised nothing, including denuclearization, and yet got a first ever summit with the U.S. president, something Pyongyang has desired for decades. Of course, apparently they hand-delivered a letter from Kim Jong-un to Dump himself, who at first, Dump said it was a very nice letter. And then a few minutes later, he said he hasn't opened the letter yet. That's because the man lies. He lies about everything. If he's opening his mouth and words are coming out, he's lying or doing something else equally reprehensible, like pardoning the worst of the worst. And people who have, no reason to be pardoned. I got the New York Times has an editorial today. Dinesh D'Souza, really? and it's not very long, so let me share it with you. The handful of pardons that President Trump has granted so far may appear to be scattershot, but they're beginning to show a distinct pattern, not just of who he believes is worthy of mercy, but of how he thinks about the justice system as a whole and about his power to bend it to his will. On Thursday, Mr. Trump pardoned Dinesh D'Souza, the right-wing troll known for, among other things, posting racist tweets about President Barack Obama, spreading the lie that George Soros was a Nazi collaborator, and writing that the American slave was treated like property, which is to say pretty well. In 2014, D'Souza pleaded guilty to making illegal campaign contributions, although he claimed that he had been targeted for political reasons. Last year, President Trump fired Preet Bharara, the federal prosecutor who handled Mr. D'Souza's case. Quote, "Karma is a bitch," Mr. D'Souza exulted on Twitter Thursday with his trademark graciousness. Mr. Bharara, he added, wanted to destroy a fellow Indian American to advance his career. Then he got fired and I got pardoned, end quote. Mr. Trump, who told reporters that Mr. D'Souza, quote, was very unfairly treated, has the authority to pardon anyone he likes for almost any reason. But pardons send a message. What message can we take from Mr. Trump's executive clemency? Well, maybe the president is sending a signal of loyalty and reassurance to friends and family members who may soon find themselves facing similar criminal charges in connection with the special counsel's Russia inquiry. That could help explain Mr. Trump's interest in Mr. D'Souza campaign finance violations, as well as two other big names he hinted on Thursday he might grant clemency to, the lifestyle maven Martha Stewart, lying to federal authorities, and former Governor Rod Blagojevich of Illinois, corruption and bribery. Oh, and a previous Trump pardon, Scooter Libby, former Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff, perjury and obstruction of justice. Or maybe Mr. Trump is wielding his pardon power against his perceived enemies in federal law enforcement. Besides Mr. Bharara, there's James Comey, who prosecuted Ms. Stewart, and Patrick Fitzgerald, who prosecuted both Mr. Blagojevich and Mr. Libby, and is a friend of Mr. Comey's. Oh, and let's not forget Joe Arpaio, the former Arizona sheriff and hunter of undocumented immigrants who Mr. Trump pardoned last summer for contempt of a federal court order. Mr. Trump clearly was thumbing his nose at the federal court that found Mr. Arpaio guilty. Or perhaps Mr. Trump simply is dealing with another hammer blow to the legacy of Mr. Obama, who focused his own clemency efforts on reducing the lengthy sentences of thousands of low-level drug offenders with no personal connection to the White House. The tendency of presidents of both parties to reward cronies with clemency, from Gerald Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon to Bill Clinton's of the financier Mark Rich, is one Washington tradition that we'd welcome Mr. Trump smashing. Alas, it's one that he shows every sign not only of continuing, but of embracing. Mr. D'Souza told the Daily Caller that Senator Ted Cruz of Texas engineered his pardon with a personal plea to the president, even though Mr. Trump told reporters, quote, "Nobody asked me to do it." Remember what I told you, everything out of his mouth is a lie. Sorry, back to the New York Times. One thing is becoming clear. Donald Trump uses whatever power he has to attack the people he feels have wronged him, and he will do what he feels he must to protect himself. For him, pardons are a means of vengeance. Those he's issued to date are only a small hint of what could be coming as the Russia investigation heats up. Last year, John Dowd, Mr. Trump's lawyer at the time, discussed the prospect of pardons for two of the president's former top advisors, Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort, with their lawyers. As Vox's David Roberts wrote on Twitter, pardoning is basically the one presidential power that works the way Trump thought all of being president worked. He's going to use the expletive out of it. That is the real message of these pardons. And that, more than Mr. Trump clearing the record of some noxious clown, is what should really worry us. Again, that is the editorial in today's New York Times. The official newspaper editorial, not an opinion piece by someone who, you know, gets to write on the op-ed pages. That is the New York Times editorial for today. Dinesh D'Souza, really? Really. And that was my reaction too when I heard the news. And in fact, I found a piece at Media Matters titled Dinesh D'Souza, The Staggering Corruption of Dinesh D'Souza's Pardon. And it's written by Media Matters senior writer. Let me get all my ducks in a row here. Simon Malloy. He's been writing about D'Souza for years. And I think we've got him on the line now. Simon, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. So for those, I think most of the people listening to this program know who Dinesh D'Souza is. But can you give us a quick refreshing of our memories?
Sure. Dinesh D'Souza is a former Reagan administration official who, during the 90s, embarked on a career as a sort of conservative intellectual. And since then, he's been steadily discrediting himself with a series of tendentious and trollish arguments about race, about, you know, he wrote a book blaming the cultural left for the 9/11 attacks. He wrote another book insisting that American slaves were treated pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in 2014, was indicted for campaign finance fraud. He set up a couple of straw donors to a Republican Senate candidate in New York named Wendy Long, who was a college friend of his. He was indicted for that. He pleaded guilty, and he got 5 years of probation and community service as his sentence, and since then has been trying to present himself as a sort of martyr who was unfairly targeted by the Obama administration because he was a conservative critic of then President Barack Obama, which and that story, as I'm sure your listeners know, culminated with Donald Trump announcing that he would be given a full pardon as someone who was treated, quote, unfairly by the government.
Now, there's a process to go through when you petition the president for a pardon. There's a whole long process, an office that handles this kind of stuff. And I know this is not what you wrote about here, but to the best of your knowledge, did D'Souza go through any of that process?
To the best of my knowledge, the way this happened was that Trump was made vaguely aware of D'Souza's situation through his rigorous television watching habits.
Uh-huh.
And Senator Ted Cruz, who is a friend of Dinesh D'Souza's, apparently brought D'Souza's case to the president's attention recently, which precipitated the announcement that that D'Souza would be pardoned. I've not heard anything to suggest that this went through the normal channels that usually govern the issuing of presidential pardons. But Trump has a habit of doing this, of just using his pardon power on the fly and issuing reprieves for people who, like, who are allies of his, like Joe
mm-hmm.
Arpaio, or people whose cases he literally just happened to see while watching Fox News.
Right. And as far as I can tell, none of the pardons he's issued have gone through those proper channels. It's just Trump sort of, you know, off the hip saying, oh, I'm going to pardon that guy, like with Arpaio. It's pretty distressing. D'Souza is one of those. I think you called him a troll. He's one of the worst of the worst of the partisan trolls out there. What kind of message do you think Trump is sending with this pardon?
Well, one of the points that I made in the piece that I wrote is that the way Trump uses his pardoning power is it's pretty openly corrupt, in that he's reserving it for a lot of his allies, ideological, political, or otherwise, and using it to bestow favors. And it also sends a message to people that if you are an ally of the president, if you are loyal to him, and you are implicated in some sort of criminal activity, then this may be a a prize given to you if you stick with your loyalty. And as we know, the president has surrounded himself with quite a few people who are under investigation for potential crimes. And they have now every reason to believe that if they just stick to their guns and refuse to cooperate with law enforcement, then they will have a pardon waiting for them on the other end. This is also, you know, someone like D'Souza, you know, he is a troll and he does say things that are abhorrent and awful. And in spite of that, he is still a very popular and respected and accepted figure within conservative politics and the conservative media. He shows up constantly on talk radio. He's on the lecture circuit with his trips underwritten by conservative activist groups. Like, this is someone who in a normal political movement would have been ostracized and shunted off to the fringes and generally treated as an extremist.
Right.
But D'Souza, because he embodies this sort of new politics of trolling liberals and saying things that are outrageous just to get a rise out of the left, he is considered this respected critic of the left. Ted Cruz, in his tweet celebrating D'Souza, called him a voice for freedom. When he's none of those things. He's a charlatan and he's a crank. He says things that are racist and bigoted, and he does it largely just because it makes liberals mad. And for that, he gets pats on the head and a pardon from the president.
That's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. We're speaking with Simon Malloy, senior writer at Media Matters for America, who has a piece up that I'll link to from my blog at NicoleSandler.com after the show. Roger Stone, who many say is, you know, possibly the next to be called in for questioning by Mueller's team, said that that this pardon is a signal. He said, Stone, a longtime Trump confidant, told the Washington Post that the president's pardon of D'Souza, quote, has to be a signal to Mike Flynn and Paul Manafort and even Robert Mueller. Indict people for crimes that don't pertain to Russian collusion, and this is what could happen. Do you think, he added, the special counsel has awesome powers, as you know, but the president has even more awesome powers. Do you think Trump is trying to send a message to those who might be toying with the idea of flipping on him?
Well, I don't know if Trump is actively or consciously trying to send that message. A lot of his pardons seem to be driven by, like I said, this sort of frenetic process wherein he gets wind of something or hears about it and then just decides, all right, I'll pardon that person. But even if he's not consciously sending that message, I mean, it's hard to see how someone like Paul Manafort would interpret it otherwise. And, you know, Roger Stone, I don't often agree with Roger Stone, but when he says something like that, he's absolutely correct. Like I said, it's a message, unintended or otherwise, to allies of the president that the president freely dispenses pardons to people he still considers his allies, and he will do so under the pretext that you have been treated unfairly. And as we've seen, the president's response to the special counsel investigation into Russian collusion has been to attack its credibility, to delegitimize it, and that all sets up this idea that anyone who is found legally culpable or in some way to have committed a criminal act will have been the victim of an unfair process, thus setting up a pardon from Trump. Now, in an ideal situation, you know, the president wouldn't be dangling pardons like this, consciously or otherwise, because that's sort of a arguably a form of witness tampering. But as Roger Stone said, the president has a lot of power, and it's difficult to challenge him, especially on the pardon issue.
We're living in far from normal times. If these were normal times, would anyone in the Republican Party come out and disavow this and say, wait a minute, this is not how these things are done?
Well, this gets to the point that I made about D'Souza being a member in good standing of conservative movement politics. Trump's abuses are the sort of unique thing about them is that he doesn't really take a lot of pains to conceal them. And the issue with these pardons, like I said, it's blatant what he's doing. He's not really hiding it, and he's just handing out pardons to his political friends, to his cronies, and the Republicans aren't going to say a word about it because it's still in their political interests to remain aligned with the president. You know, you're talking about in like a normal political environment. In a normal political environment, I don't think we would have a president like Trump who would so flagrantly and almost proudly flout convention and abuse his powers the way he does. And it's a testament to the corruption within conservative politics and Republican politics that no one is willing to step out and say anything about this. It's quite the opposite, in fact, because you have people like Ted Cruz who is engineering these pardons and then coming out and celebrating them and celebrating the president for using his official powers on behalf of one of his allies with no real pretext behind it. So it's really distressing.
It is distressing. What are your thoughts, Simon, when you realize that we've got another 2.5 years at least of this guy in the White House?
Well, we're going to see more of this as the special counsel investigation wends towards what I assume will be its eventual termination. There's going to be a reckoning between what Robert Mueller's office has been pursuing and Donald Trump's and his allies' campaign to try and discredit the investigation. You know, I can't pretend to know what Robert Mueller is looking at or has planned. But you know, if in any way he comes close to putting into legal jeopardy anyone the president really cares about, member of his family or close political confidant, then you're going to see, I think, the president use his powers to try and stymie any sort of consequence for that person or people. And that's going to cause, I think, a political crisis. But... again, it depends largely on which party is in power to actually provide a check to the president. And as we've seen up to this point, the GOP has been largely okay with every abuse that the president has meted out. And I don't really have any reason to think that they would behave any differently in the event that he tries to undermine the Russia investigation through the free dispensing of pardons. So it doesn't look good from my end, but I tend to be a pessimist on these things.
I'm with you.
So I guess we just have to wait and see.
And work our way through it. Simon Malloy, again, a senior writer at Media Matters for America. He's been writing about D'Souza for years and has a piece up at MediaMatters.org, The Staggering Corruption of Dinesh D'Souza's pardon. I'll link to it from my blog where I post today's podcast at NicoleSandler.com. Simon, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Dinesh D'Souza, I mean, seriously, of all people. You know what? It's going to keep getting worse. It really is. I don't even know where to go from here. I've noticed the right wingers, the trolls on Twitter, are going nuts over Samantha Bee, who maybe used the poor choice of words. Again, I don't like. We do a disclaimer at the beginning of the show, so I can use bad words to know that I do. I still don't use the C word. I really don't. I think it's an ugly word. I wonder if I think I had it bookmarked because people in the chat room were talking about Sally Field, of all people, had the best response to it. Did I flag it? I mean, there are some great ones. Minnie Driver said that was the wrong word for Samantha Bee to have used, but mostly because, to paraphrase the French, Ivanka has neither the warmth nor the depth, to be called a C word. No, I can't find it, but I will. Sally Field, again, had, let me see if I can pull it up real quickly this way. Sally Field, let's see. Here, Sally Field tweeted, "I like Samantha Bee a lot, but she is flat wrong to call Ivanka a cunt. Cunts are powerful, beautiful, nurturing, and honest." Touche, my friend, touche. All right, we will take a break. We'll do today's What's News. And on the other side, Someone who's been on the show before but hasn't been here in a while. He is a he's a longtime Democratic and progressive movement strategist and author of two books. The new one is out today, and it's called How to Democrat in the Age of Trump. And I think it's a lesson we could all use. So we'll speak with Mike Lux in just a few minutes. But first,
I read the news today. Oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
On Thursday, Donald Trump enacted the most severe economic penalties he has imposed to date against U.S. allies, establishing tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. The trade partners are expected to retaliate in what is becoming a fast-developing global trade war. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said months of intense negotiations between his country, the United States, and Mexico imploded Tuesday when Vice President Mike Pence demanded that any deal expire automatically in 5 years.
Let me be clear. These tariffs are totally unacceptable. Americans remain our partners, our allies, and our friends. This is not about the American people. We have to believe that at some point, common sense will prevail. But we see no sign of that in this action today by the U.S. administration.
Donald Trump's use of the presidential power of the pardon is under scrutiny once again after he announced on Thursday he would erase the conviction of conservative commentator Dinesh D'Souza, prompting a New York Times editorial that reads in part, "On Thursday, Mr. Trump pardoned Dinesh D'Souza, the right-wing troll known for, among other things, posting racist tweets about President Barack Obama, spreading the lie that George Soros was a Nazi collaborator, and writing that, quote, the American slave was treated like property, which is to say, pretty well, end quote." D'Souza, of course, appeared on Fox and Friends Friday morning.
President said, Dinesh, you've been a great voice for freedom. And he said that, I got to tell you, man to man, you've been screwed. He goes, I've been looking at the case. I knew from the beginning that it was fishy. But he said upon reviewing it, he felt a great injustice had been done. And that using his power, he was going to rectify it, sort of clear the slate. And he said he just wanted me to be out there to be a bigger voice than ever, defending the principles that I believe in.
The decision for D'Souza came on top of recent pardons for the late heavyweight boxing champion Jack Johnson, as well as Louis Scooter Libby, a former chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney during the George W. Bush administration. The political nature of some of Trump's pardons disquiets his critics, especially when set against the backdrop of his jabs at the Department of Justice, FBI, and Special Counsel Robert Mueller. CNN's Anderson Cooper weighed in.
Under the Constitution, a president's authority to pardon people for federal offenses or grant clemency in such cases is, depending on which legal scholar you ask, either absolute or very nearly so. So today, when the president issued yet another pardon, few, if any, questioned his power to do it. But there are questions about his judgment and intent, especially whether he's using this and other pardons to send a message to anyone contemplating a plea deal in the Russia investigation. Hang tough, keep quiet, I'll take care of you would be the message. Dinesh D'Souza, who he pardoned today, is a right-wing author and filmmaker who pleaded guilty to campaign finance violations. He's also an Obama and Clinton hater. He also said he's thinking about commuting the sentence of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, a Democrat who, among his other corrupt acts, tried to sell President Obama's vacated Senate seat. Additionally, the president says he's considering a pardon from Martha Stewart, convicted of lying to federal investigators.
Comedian and political commentator Samantha Bee has come under fire for using a certain expletive to describe Ivanka Trump on her show Full Frontal on Wednesday night.
We know this isn't just about breaking the law because you're also doing this to families who are legally seeking asylum.
Woman fleeing the Congo. She comes to the United States, not sneaking in. She's showing up at a port of entry to say, I am here seeking asylum in America. And the U.S. government does what?
Oh, let me guess. The usual? They took her daughter away? Oh, yeah, that's right. Two people following the process to the letter were forcibly separated and spent their first 4 months in this country detained in different time zones. So now, after decades of ignoring the issue, Americans are finally paying attention. Well, most of us, Ivanka Trump, who works at the White House, chose to post the second most oblivious tweet we've seen this week. You know, Ivanka, that's a beautiful photo of you and your child, but let me just say, one mother to another, do something about your dad's immigration practices, you feckless c-. He listens to you. Put on something tight and low cut and tell your father to f***ing stop it. Tell him it was an Obama thing and see how it goes, okay?
Although Samantha Bee apologized by tweeting, I would like to sincerely apologize to Ivanka Trump and to my viewers for using an expletive on my show to describe her last night. It was inappropriate and inexcusable. I crossed a line and I deeply regret it. Donald Trump has demanded she be fired. He must have forgotten that after Ted Nugent called Hillary Clinton the same offensive C word that Sam B called Ivanka Trump and never apologized, he was invited to the Oval Office for a photo op with Trump. But the White House demands that Samantha Bee be fired. Just saying. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener funded and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
You're listening to the Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back. Nicole Sandler here with you at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. We're going to change directions now and talk to someone who's been on the program before. Mike Lux is a longtime progressive movement and Democratic Party strategist, the author of two books. The new one being released today is called How to Democrat in the Age of Trump. Something we could all use some help with because it's uncharted territory. Hey, Mike Lux.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm all right. It's good to be back on your program, Nicole.
Well, it's good to have you here, and thank you for writing this book. I think it's important because many of us are struggling with not only how to, well, you use Democrat as a verb. I'll have to ask you about that.
Yeah.
But how to survive in the age of Trump. Many of us are having a difficult time of that. But let's talk about how to Democrat. What does it mean to Democrat?
Well, I think the essential notion is that we wanted to turn Democrat into a verb because Democrats should be about action. Democrats should be about taking action. Democrats should be about driving the action, and that we need an agenda that is all about action. So we just decided to turn the word into a verb in the title of the book. So that was the idea of that, and plus we just thought it was kind of fun and playful, which we need a little bit of too. So anyway, my colleague Lauren Windsor, has Lauren been on your show before?
No.
Talking about, you know, she does a lot of work against the Koch brothers and against James O'Keefe and all those sleazy characters. So I thought she might have been on the show as well. But anyway, Lauren is the one who came up with the title, and I thought it was a great title and a lot of fun. So anyway, that's how we came up with
Got
that.
Got it. Well, you describe this as your take on what both Democrats and progressives in this critical moment in history ought to be doing to win the day against Trumpism and the ugliness of the modern Republican Party. That's a huge lift. I mean, it seems like the battles that we fought against Bush seemed to be insurmountable, but we seem to have entered an entirely different era with Trump because there's no rhyme or reason. There's no sense behind what this man is doing. The lunatic truly is running the asylum right now.
Well, he is. And Nicole, can I swear on your program?
Absolutely.
I talk in the book about how what Trump is basically arguing for, what his presidency is all about, is he wants freedom.
He wants people to have freedom, but his definition of freedom is the freedom to be an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he wants. That's what he's all about. And he is. I mean, this presidency is about cruelty. It's about treating other people poorly. It's about lying to people. It's about screwing your workers and dumping toxic shit into your environment. I mean, that's their definition of freedom. And I think we have to counter that with our own definition of freedom, which is the freedom to build a good life for ourselves and our families, free of the domination of big corporations, and free of the assholes who want to try to run our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that's to me, that's an essential argument about the future that we have to make.
You say that to come up with solutions, you have to identify the problems. The Democrats have a lot of problems right now. There are a lot of people who, as much as they despise the Republicans, you know, that goes without saying, they don't look at the Democratic Party as the fix, as the solution. So how do we change that perception? Because although, look, I'm one of them. I'm one who, after, you know, I saw the way the Democratic Party treated Bernie Sanders, I was ready to leave. And then I realized, where the hell am I going to go if we want to get rid of these Republicans, get them out of power, neuter Trump at least a little bit? The only way we're going to be able to do that, at least in the short run, is through the Democratic Party. But I see a party that continuously, I mean, does things like campaign against the progressives who are running for Congress. It's a bit disconcerting. So how do we go? I can help you identify some of the problems within the Democratic Party.
Well, and I do, you know, the book is about what we need to do to solve the problems in the party.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more about solutions than the problems. But I do spend a lot of time in the first couple chapters really talking about what I see as the problems in our party, and I address some of the things that you were just talking about, Nicole. We have become, and I say we because, frankly, I mean, I'm a Washington insider too. I've been here. I've been in this city now. I live in the D.C. area. I've been in this city for a long time, and I've been part of presidential campaigns. I worked in the Clinton White House. I worked on the Obama transition. I worked at the DNC for the last couple months of the last election. I think the party leadership has become blind to a lot of the party leadership, I should say, not all of it, but has become blind to a lot of what's going on in the world and have stopped listening to the grassroots. And I think until we rebuild the bridge between the grassroots, folks in the Democratic Party, the activists, the people on the ground, the people from the bottom up, and rebuild the bridge between them and the party leaders in Washington, we're never going to get anywhere, and the Democrats will never win. The top-down approach winning elections has not been working for us, and it's not going to work for us.
Mm-hmm.
I am firmly convinced that if we don't really solve our own internal problems, that we're going to keep losing elections. And right now, losing elections is about as devastating as you can be. It's like you say, Trump and these folks are literally destroying the country.
Yeah.
Ripping apart the democracy, ripping apart the rule of law, destroying the country in which we live. And if we're going to take it back, we have to do that through winning elections. And, Democrats and the progressive movement need to come to terms, need to figure out how to work together to do that. And I think it needs to start by the party leadership listening more to people at the grassroots level.
Mike Lux, from your words to, Nancy Pelosi's ears. Howie Klein is a regular on this program. He's on with me every Thursday. Yeah. And you know, we always...
Howie's a friend. I love him.
Howie's great. And, right now we're in the heart of primary season. This is when we can actually get real progressives in place to run in November. But it seems like, the DCCC especially does its part to not only dissuade the progressives from running, but sabotage them in many senses. And they don't seem to want to listen to those of us who have, who are saying, wait a minute, we're progressives, we're part of the party. Do you remember the platform we voted on in 2016?
Right.
So how do we get the party itself to listen or to make the changes that that the people want?
Well, I think part of the answer, Nicole, is time. Time is on the progressive movement and grassroots Democrats side.
Is it?
I think we're already seeing it that we're going to win more elections. It's not consistent yet. I mean, we're still losing a lot of these primaries, but we're winning more and more. Grassroots candidates are coming up through the ranks and are taking on the establishment candidates, and they're winning. And I think that's a great thing. And we're not seeing it everywhere, but we're seeing it in some big places. We saw it in the Kentucky congressional race.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it in Omaha recently. My home state is Nebraska. That was quite a victory. And I think over time, I think we're going to see in the 2020 election, we're going to see some strong progressive candidates running at the top of the ticket for president and all the way down. And I think a lot of them are going to do extremely well. So I think we don't have a lot of time. That's the scary thing. But I think we are winning this debate over the long run. The question is how we get the party to listen in the shorter run. But I think the more we do, win some of these primaries, the more we do push back, the better off we'll be. And I'm seeing evidence of it in various places. I think that the party establishment is starting to realize that, some things need to change. And I'll give you one example, which I talked about briefly in my book, but Nancy Pelosi has now started doing regular conference calls with progressive leaders from both some different groups and also some grassroots people, some people who run Facebook pages, some people who are more net roots oriented. I've been on a few of those calls. I have colleagues who have been on, who actually work on the call or organize the calls, help mm-hmm. organize the calls. And so now is Nancy Pelosi just automatically like turning our way on everything? Of course not. But she's listening. I mean, I've actually been impressed with how much she's listening, and she is responding to some things. And I think I see evidence that she's moving. So, I mean, I think this is something that's going to happen over time. And I think the party is going to have to get its fingers burned at the stove, a few more times. But I think there's hope and promise, and I think in 2020 I think we have a very good chance of a strong progressive candidate winning the nomination, which I would love to see, and which I think would change a lot of things if that were to happen.
Oh, without a doubt. But first, we got to get through the 2018 elections. We're speaking with Mike Lux, a longtime Progressive Movement and Democratic Party strategist whose brand new book is out today. It's called How to Democrat in the Age of Trump. So we are in the midst of, you know, the 2018 midterm primary season. And, it's hard to, I'll use the verb Democrat, when I see the Democratic leaders pushing back against the progressive candidates that I want to see. We saw it in Texas with Laura Moser, who did the, you know, who took the high road when she lost in the runoff. She immediately jumped in and supported Lizzie, whose last name is eluding me now, but the woman who beat her, who is a more establishment Democrat. But, you know, you mentioned Nebraska, and you're from Omaha. We had Kara Eastman there, who, despite the party basically running against her, pulled out a victory. And instead of putting her on the, removing her former opponent from the red to blue list and replacing it with Kara Eastman, they didn't. They're ignoring her race. How do we get them to do the right thing as just Democrats, as people who want to see big victories in November? What are we supposed to do?
Well, first of all, I do want to do a shout out to Laura Moser, who actually heard about this book from my publisher. My publisher is called Strong Arm Press.
Mm-hmm.
Great publishing house that's run by Ryan Grimm, who wrote for many years for Huffington Post, and by Alex Lawson, who runs Social Security Works, great activist.
Yep.
It's a progressive publishing house. And Laura is friends with Alex, and he told her about the book, and she got so excited about it that she's actually doing a big email to her list about the book.
Oh, good for her.
So in part because I talk about this dynamic with the party committees and what they do. I want to thank Laura on air, because I know a lot of your listeners know about her.
Mm-hmm.
and know about what she went through, but also to talk about the Omaha race. The Omaha race is a classic example of the changing dynamic in the party. So you had this ex-member of Congress who was trying to get his seat back, and that's who the party, the D.C. party establishment, endorsed. But the county chair in Omaha, Douglas County is the name of the county, actually endorsed Kara Eastman against the national party establishment. And a lot of the local folks got excited about her and got excited about the race. And she did end up winning. It was a huge upset. You know, nobody was predicting it. Nobody was expecting it. But that grassroots energy was there. And since that time, I know that the state party chair, who's an old Bernie person, Bernie won Nebraska big. People think progressive candidates can't win, but Bernie won a lot of states like Nebraska big, and he won Nebraska big. Jane is a Bernie person, Jane Kleb, who's the state chair. And Jane talked the DCCC into they're not yet moving Kara to red to blue program. But she talked them into leaving a couple of their staffers who'd been placed there for the other candidate, leaving them in Omaha to continue to do grassroots organizing. And sort of, so they're like, they're not ready to jump on, but they're taking a wait and see approach.
Wow.
And to me, that was a good sign. Like, okay.
Baby steps.
They're not ready to jump, but they're keeping an open mind. So that's the kind of dialogue. If we can elect local officials, if we can elect local party people, state party people who are strongly progressive, and then they can start those dialogues with the national party, I think that's a good sign. In the Kentucky race that we were talking about, where the mayor of Louisville, who I know and who's a good guy, Jim Gray is his name,
but he was the party establishment candidate. But the woman who won is a great progressive, strongly supported by the grassroots. She kicked his butt in the primary election.
Right.
And the DCCC was like, you know what? Okay, we're going to jump into this race. And so they went ahead and jumped in, even though their candidate lost, which to me was like a great sign, because usually the history of the party committees is like, once their favorite candidate wins, they're gone, or loses, they're gone.
But Mike, should the party be taking an active role in a primary?
Well, no. I mean, that is that's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you, I've been actually in conversation with the DNC since Tom Perez endorsed Cuomo in the New York.
Like, what the hell?
Primary. And I will say that decision caused a lot of blowback to the DNC. And Perez is now indicating to a lot of us that he's not going to do that again, that he's not going to jump into primaries, that I don't know if he would say that he realized it was a mistake. I don't want to speak for him. But what we're hearing now is that he's not planning to do that again. And so he understood the feedback and is changing his posture as a result. And I think that's a good sign. I this is not going to happen overnight. The party committee folks are used to thinking that they should run the show. But I do think that there is movement. And I think if grassroots progressives, keep working and, keep pushing, I think that we will see changes. And again, I think we'll see some of them this year. We may see a lot more in 2020, especially if a strong progressive candidate wins that presidential nomination.
So
that's going to be a crucial fight.
Yes, it is. And again, I know the importance of 2020, but I also don't want to downplay the importance of 2018.
And I agree with that.
And the necessity of the Democrats taking back at least the House, if not both the House and Senate. I know the Senate's going to be a heavier lift. The House is within sight. And yet, once again, we have the DCCC seemingly working at odds against itself. Is there any advice in the book? How to Democrat in the Age of Trump? It's to how to Democrat better to get the elders in the party to see that maybe they've made a few mistakes along the way.
Well, I give a lot of advice actually to the elders. Some of the book is talking to my the people. I've known a lot of these folks for a long time, because I came to D.C. In the Clinton years, and I was on the left edge of the Clinton administration, but I was a Clinton insider and worked in the Clinton White House. And so I've known a lot of these folks for a long time. And we've banged heads and we've disagreed on a lot of things. But I still think that there's some willingness to listen. And I wrote the book in part to give advice to grassroots Democrats about message, about organizing, but in part to give some advice to these Democrats here in D.C. And so I spend a chunk of a big chunk of one chapter is advice directly given to the party committees about what they should be doing, and I do advocate them not getting involved in primaries, but I also advocate them actively listening, like actually going out and not just meeting with candidates, but with groups in local levels, which, by the way, Keith Ellison, in his role as deputy DNC chair, I mentioned Keith a couple times in the book, but he's done a terrific job of going out and meeting with progressive grassroots folks, not just the leaders here in Washington, mm-hmm. but he's gone on the road and he's done meetings with local grassroots activists. I think that's exactly the kind of approach that the party committee should do. When they go into a district to try to recruit a candidate, they ought to sit down with local progressives and talk to them about what they think's going on the ground. They ought to get their feedback. I also talk about how the party committees need to think very consciously about recruiting and hiring staffers who have a diverse point of view. Too many staffers come out of the D.C. Beltway mentality, but we need to have a diversity. We need to have a diversity in terms of their gender, in terms of their race, but we also need to have a diversity in terms of the way they think, in terms of their approach to these things. So, so that's a big part of what I talk about in the book. I think in terms of progressives, what we should be doing. I mean, I just think we all need to keep working, keep getting better as organizers, and we will start taking over local parties. We'll start taking over state parties. We'll start raising enough money in outside organizations and in blogs like Howie's that, we will start winning more and more primaries, which is, like I say, already starting to happen. So I think, things will change. And I think you saw that. I mean, I'll give you another example. The Virginia elections last year, mm-hmm. a lot of the candidates who won those House races, everybody was so shocked that the Democrats picked up 15 seats in the House. One of the reasons they picked up all those seats is that a lot of the people who emerged out of those primaries were younger women, people of color, who ran on progressive platform. And so the Virginia party is now like looking at every, like, wow, look at what happened. And a lot of the turnout that happened in that election for the governor's race actually came because of the great grassroots organizing from these progressive young candidates on the ground. So, I mean, what a story, and I do think that has that party leaders have noticed. So I think there's a lot of hope out there. I think there's a lot of people engaging, and I'm seeing the change happening, and I think we all just need to keep pushing.
Should, given that the Democrats take back the House in November, should Nancy Pelosi stay on as Speaker?
Well, my feeling is always in elections, compared to what? I think if the choice is between her and Steny Hoyer, I think Nancy Pelosi should continue to be the Speaker, right? Mm-hmm. If the choice is between her and some young corporate person sort of coming up, who's going to be there for a long time with kind of the corporate money as the primary backing, I'd rather have an older person who's there another couple of years, and then maybe somebody like a Keith Ellison or an up and comer,
a Pramila Jayapal or a Ted Lieu or
a
Mark
Pocan. I would much rather have them run for leadership in a couple of years rather than us get someone who's going to be bad for the next 20.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it all depends. If Keith Ellison or Pramila or Ted Lieu, were to run for leadership, I think that would be awesome. But I don't know if it's going to happen this next year.
Right,
or not.
It might be too soon.
So anyway, compared to what, right?
Right. Right. Always consider the alternative. Mike Lux, again, a longtime progressive strategist, and we're lucky to have you fighting on our behalf. The brand new book out today called How to Democrat in the Age of Trump. It's available through Amazon and all the usual retailers. I'll have a link up on my blog at NicoleSandler.com along with today's podcast. Mike Lux, thank you for doing the heavy lifting. I know it's not easy sometimes, and I always appreciate your voice. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Nicole. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. You're great.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. We'll talk soon. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. These are the kind of books we need to buy. These are the kind of people working in the Democratic Party we need to celebrate. We need to support. Have a great weekend, everyone. Until next time.